It's time for the Fringe Files.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day.
So welcome back to the Fringe Files and the much-awaited part three and final episode of the New World Order, The Creature from Jekyll Island. Hope you enjoyed this. I apologize that we've done a couple of extra podcasts in the middle, but there was just some topics I felt like I needed to cover. I hope you enjoy this, and here's part three.
New departments of economics handpicked their own people to be the professors to chair those departments. And then those professors began to give speeches and write scholarly essays about how wonderful the Federal Reserve System was. And then at the insistence of Paul Warburg, they added a few excellent provisions to the bill, provisions which seriously restricted the ability of the Federal Reserve System to create money out of nothing. And Warburg's associate said to him, "Paul, what are you doing? We don't want that in our bill." And his reply was classic. He said, "Relax, fellas, don't you get it? Our object is to get the bill passed. We can fix it up later." It was because of those provisions that they won over the support at long last of William Jennings Bryan, who was the head of the populist movement. He had opposed this bill from the beginning, but when he saw those excellent provisions in there, he said, "Oh, well, I guess now I can support this bill." And with his collapse of opposition, the road was now clear, and everybody was for, almost everyone, except a few lone voices, was for the Federal Reserve. And indeed, they did fix it up later. Since the Federal Reserve bill was passed, it has been amended over 100 times, and every one of those excellent provisions were long ago removed, and many more have been added, which greatly expanded the power and reach of the Federal Reserve System. And so, with this professional, brilliant strategy and deception, it is no surprise that eventually the public and Congress was solidly for the Federal Reserve System. And the bill was passed on December 22, 1913, and the creature from Jekyll Island finally moved into Washington, D.C. I'd like to focus for a moment on what are the objectives of the Federal Reserve System, because, you know, we're told that the purpose of the Fed is to stabilize the economy and to put an end to chaotic banking. One of the more popular textbooks used in our colleges and junior colleges today is a textbook on economics written by Paul Samuelson. And here's what he says. He says the Federal Reserve sprang from the panic of 1907 with its alarming epidemic of bank failures. The country was fed up once and for all with the anarchy of unstable private banking. Well, that's what he said, and that's what the students are learning. Let's not challenge that for the moment. Let's just take it at face value, because this is the official doctrine, isn't it? The purpose of the Fed is to stabilize the economy and to protect the people. That's why they're raising our interest rates right now. That's what Greenspan says. Why is he doing this? To help people, right? To stabilize the economy so we won't have massive inflation. It's for you folks that he's doing this. See? That's what he says. And if you're trying to figure it out on the basis of these official pronouncements, you'll never get it. Let's just take this official pronouncement at face value for a moment and see how well it's doing. Let's give it a report card. Since the Federal Reserve was created, it has presided over the crashes of 1921 and 1929, the Great Depression of 29 through 39, Recessions in the years 53, 57, 69, 75, and 81. A stock market Black Monday in 87. We all know that corporate debt is soaring. Personal debt is greater than ever. Both business and personal bankruptcies are at an all-time high. Banks and savings and loan associations have failed in larger numbers than ever before. Interest on the national debt is consuming half of our tax dollars. Heavy industry has all been but replaced by overseas competitors. We're facing an international trade deficit for the first time in our history. 75% of downtown Los Angeles and other metropolitan areas is now owned by foreigners, and over half of the nation now officially is in a state of recession. Now, that's the report card of the Federal Reserve System after 80 years of stabilizing our economy. I don't think it's even controversial to say that it has failed to meet its stated objectives. The only controversial issue is, why has it failed? And my answer is, because those have never been its true objectives. What are its true objectives? Well, what are the objectives of any cartel? To enhance the profit margins of the members of the cartel and to stabilize their position in the market. If we hold that in mind, now we get a different picture folding before us. Now they're not failing at all. They're succeeding. There were three objectives that the bankers had, the ones on Jekyll Island. They had three objectives in 1910 through 1913 that they wanted the Federal Reserve System to accomplish for them, and they were very verbose on the topic. And here they are. They said, first, they wanted to stop the erosion of their power away from New York. That's right. Exactly the opposite of what the Federal Reserve System was supposed to accomplish. That's what they wanted. This is a good point to mention that when we talk about the cartel, I'm not talking about the small banks that are struggling for survival under the Federal Reserve System. Remember, John D. Rockefeller said competition is a sin. And one of the purposes of the cartel was to put a check on the competition from these new banks, keep them in their place, eliminate them if possible, and to do so through regulation. Setting up conditions that the big banks could afford to handle, but the small banks could not handle. So I'm not talking about your local banker now. I'm talking about the New York cartel. That was objective number one. Objective number two was to reverse the trend of what they call private capital formation. Now that's banker language for a trend in which individuals or businesses use their own savings for something instead of going to the bank and borrowing money for it. At the turn of the century, there was a trend toward private capital formation in business, particularly. Businesses were holding back a certain portion of their dividends each quarter, putting that money into a sinking fund, and then as the capital formed, or as they saved more and more money, then they used their own savings to build a new factory or to launch a research and development project or whatever. And the banks were extremely concerned over this trend. They wanted to entice businesses back into the banks to borrow money. And they knew that the only way to do that is to lower interest rates. And you may say, well, why didn't they just lower interest rates? Because you're thinking in terms of today, not then. Today it's easy if you're the Federal Reserve System to lower interest rates because they have the lever to move it either way, up or down, totally within their control. But in 1913, there was no lever because the money in those days was backed by gold and silver. And you can't hook a lever onto that kind of money. Under those conditions, interest rates are the result of the natural forces of supply and demand. People cannot control it. I mean, individuals or committees cannot control it. Millions of people interacting in freedom control it, supply and demand. But it's not subject to political control. And they knew that the only way that they could get people into the banks is to artificially depress the natural interest rate. How do you do that? They said that the answer was through a flexible currency. They said what the nation needed was a flexible currency to meet the demands of industry. Well, what is a flexible currency? It's not this stuff that bends. You need a dictionary to understand some of these things. A flexible currency, ladies and gentlemen, is money made out of nothing. That's what that means. I see the trick is not too complicated. If you can create money out of nothing, you don't have to charge an awful lot of interest on it to show a profit. So, with a flexible currency, they could lower the interest rates below the natural level, still make plenty of profit on it, and entice the businessmen back into the banks. So the goal was a flexible currency. That was objective number two. And objective number three was to pass on the inevitable losses of the banks, pass them on to the taxpayers in the name of... That was objective number two. And objective number three was to pass on the inevitable losses of the banks, pass them on to the taxpayers in the name of protecting the people. Now, those are the true objectives of the Federal Reserve. Let's now issue another report card and see how well it did. Did it keep control with the larger banks in New York? And the answer is yes. We have big banks in the West and in the South, but they are nothing compared to these mega banks in New York, which stride the world with offices in Peking and Moscow and Africa, everywhere. The big banks continue to dominate. It gets an A on its report card for retaining control in New York. What about reversing the trend toward private capital formation? Boy, did it ever. Interest rates have been pushed down over periods of time. They're so attractive that individuals and corporations thought they were crazy not to take advantage of those low interest rates. Why save your money? That's stupid. So they were all enticed into the banks because of a flexible currency. And then, of course, they get loaned up to the eyebrows and something happens in the economy and you can't service your debt anymore, you go bankrupt. Right now, there are many corporations just and individuals just hanging in there by the skin of their teeth because they're trying to service their debt. And it's an amazing fact that many of these large corporations are now sending more money every quarter to the banks as interest payments than they send to the stockholders as dividends. Just think about that. The banks who made the money out of nothing are making more money out of large segments of our industry than the people who worked for their money, saved their money, invested their money, risked their money to purchase ownership shares in those corporations. And the Federal Reserve System gets an A on its report card because, indeed, with flexible currency, it reversed the trend toward private capital formation. Were they able to pass along their losses to the taxpayer in the name of protecting the people? Maybe you missed that part of it, but it's called bailout. The game called bailout. It is played something like this. Whenever one of the large banks gets into trouble because someone it has loaned money to, either a big corporation or a third world country, can no longer pay its debt, so the bank is in trouble. It goes to Congress, and it carefully explains to Congress that it must bail out that corporation or that third world country, because otherwise it's going to hurt the people of America. If that venerable corporation is allowed to fold, look at how many thousands of jobs will be lost. People will be put on welfare. They'll be out of work, and that'll hurt the people. If that country down in South America cannot pay its loan, Uncle Sam better pay it for him, because otherwise the venerable bank in New York will have to write the loan off of its books, and then technically it'll be bankrupt. It may have to close its doors. It would collapse. And look at the thousands of people who have money in that bank who would be hurt by that. And who knows, that bank is such a big bank. If it fell, it might be the first domino causing all the other banks to fall. And we could have a major recession or depression on our hands, and look how the people of America would suffer. And so Congress dutifully runs to the front and says, yes, yes, we don't want any of that to happen. And they vote the funds to guarantee the loans, or in some cases to make outright payments to keep that river of interest payments going to the banks. Not the small banks, the big banks. Here are some of the games you may have missed. Penn Central Railroad was bailed out in 1970. Lockheed Corporation also in 1970, Commonwealth Bank of Detroit in 1972, New York City in 1975, Chrysler Corporation in 1978, First Pennsylvania Bank in 1980, Continental Illinois, the largest of the banks so far, in 1982, and all of those countries in the third world who can no longer make their interest payments are now making their payments because they got the money from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, which got it from the Federal Reserve System, which got it from you and me through the Mandrake mechanism. And my final topic before I reach the conclusion is one that I think you'll find interesting, and that is usury. In the old days, the biblical times, usury was defined as interest on a loan. Any interest on any loan was usury. Well, in modern times, that's been redefined to mean excessive interest on a loan, not moderate interest, because, this is in keeping with the concept that if we work hard for our money, we save our money, we don't spend it, we sacrifice its pleasure, and we loan it to somebody for their venture, we're entitled to a reasonable return for that sacrifice. A reasonable interest seems fair and logical to most people. But what is this thing, excessive interest? Thomas Edison said, "People who will not turn a shovelful of dirt on the project, nor contribute a pound of materials, will collect more money than will the people who will supply all the materials and do all the work." I wondered about that when I read it. I thought, was Tom exaggerating? So I got my calculator out and I punched in the numbers. I took, for an example, a $100,000 house to be built. I assumed the $30,000 was going to go for the land and the architect's fees and the permits, that $70,000 would go for the actual construction of the house, the labor and the materials. I assumed that the buyer would go to the bank, put 20% down, take out a 30-year loan at 10% interest. I punched in the numbers, and I found out that the borrower will pay to the bank in interest $172,741 as compared to $70,000 paid for those who did all the labor and did all the work. In other words, the bank will earn 2.5 times as much money as those who produced. You may say, well, yes, but don't forget the time value of money. When you save money and you sacrifice its use, and 30 years is a long period of time and all this. No, not this money, ladies and gentlemen. Nobody worked for this money. Nobody sacrificed. Nobody saved it. This money was created out of nothing. And I suggest that $172,741 interest on nothing is excessive. I think it's time for a new definition of the word usury. Any interest on any loan of fiat money, meaning money made out of nothing. Now, this example of a $100,000 house, I should point out to you, is a grain of sand in the Sahara. This is nothing. You have to multiply this process by every house in America, by every hotel in America, every high-rise office building in America, Every jet airplane, every automobile, every factory, every warehouse full of materials, every farm building, all the farm equipment. And you are talking about a river of unearned wealth perpetually flowing into the banking cartel that is so wide that you can't even think across it in your mind. The numbers are beyond comprehension. Where is this money going? You get the mental picture that maybe it's going into a big lake someplace. There's a big dam and it's building up. All this money is accumulating and these people are getting richer and richer and richer. Wrong. Doesn't work that way. When a person has all the wealth that he can possibly want, or use for the pleasures of life, what is left? Power. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, they're spending this money, this river of wealth is being used to acquire power over you and me and our children. And I don't mean they're buying up the real estate and the hardware. They're buying up control over the organizations, the institutions, through which people live and act and rely on for leadership and opinion. Technically, in sociological terms, this is called a power center. These are the power centers of society, the groups through which people work. And this is where that money has been going, is to acquire control over these groups and institutions by buying up influence and control over the people who run them. And they're spending the money on that. That means that they're buying up politicians, political parties, television networks, cable networks, newspapers, magazines, publishing houses, wire services, motion picture studios, universities, labor unions, church organizations, trade associations, tax-exempt foundations, multinational corporations, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, you name it. Any group, any institution which exercises influence has been a target for control, and they have a lot of money to spend to acquire that control, especially those organizations and individuals which supposedly are in opposition to themselves. This process has been going on not only in our country, and in a more or less parallel manner in the other industrialized nations of the world, but ladies and gentlemen, in the so-called third world or underdeveloped nations, it has gone on so much further than you can ever imagine. In fact, it is now complete. These countries have been purchased already with this money. Did you ever wonder what's going on there at the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank? You don't hear much about that. Every once in a while, on the back page of the newspaper, you'll read that Congress authorized another $100 billion to go to the IMF, to be loaned to some little country or given to them, and they explain to us that this is to raise their standard of living. Well, you don't believe that either. That is an appearance of the fourth kind. It's not going to raise their standard of living. If it is, if that's the true purpose, they're not doing a very good job of it, are they? Because, you know, if you look at those nations, after all of these decades and the expenditures of hundreds of billions of dollars, you cannot point to one nation that has had its standard of living raised one iota. In fact, in most cases, it's the other way around. The reason is simple. That's not the purpose of the money. The money does not go to the people. It does not go to the businesses in those countries, which might have a chance of raising the standard of living. It goes to the politicians in those countries, to the governments. And it is used specifically to strengthen their control mechanisms over the people, to build collectivist totalitarian systems. Countries that start off as inefficient dictatorships get all the money from the United Nations and end up as efficient dictatorships. The money is used to strengthen their army and to strengthen their bureaucracies. These people, for the most part, couldn't care less about the standard of living of their subjects, so long as they live well. So long as they have their mansions and their yachts and their jet aircraft and their trips to New York, to the United Nations, and their suites at the Waldorf Astoria. Ideology means nothing to them. Socialism, communism, capitalism, fascism, what does it matter? Where is the money? This is it. And we're now dealing with second and third generation welfare families here. You know how hard it is to break a welfare family in our own country after the second and third generation. We have governments around the world that are now second and third generation welfare to the UN. There's not a chance in the world they're going to break away from that money. They wouldn't know how to operate any other way. It's a way of life. They're addicted. And they now are in place in the New World Order, where they're just waiting for you and me to show up. In fact, that's the other side of this. Not only has this transfer of wealth from America to the Third World not raised their standard of living, but it has indeed helped to lower ours. And that, too, was part of the plan. In many ways, they're trying just to waste money, to reduce our standard of living. A strong nation is not a candidate to surrender its sovereignty, but a weak nation is. If America can be brought to her knees, if she can be hungry, if she can be filled with despair, if there can be riots in her streets and she doesn't know where to turn, then she perhaps will willingly accept totalitarian measures from a United Nations peacekeeping force. The Blue Helmets might even be welcomed, or rescue with an international monetary unit that has purchasing power for a while. This is how it's being played out, ladies and gentlemen. And so I want to just conclude by saying that the name of the game is not wealth. It is power. So what are we going to do about this? Well, it's obvious we have to slay the creature. Obviously, that's the starting point. We can't allow this creature to continue. It has to be eliminated. But how are you going to do that? We're going to do it in Congress. Congress created the Federal Reserve System, and Congress can abolish the Fed. But we have to build some fire under the chairs of those congressmen. We have to get some new faces in there. I don't care whether it's Republican or Democrat or Independent or what have you. The titles are not important. It's what they believe in, the principles. Those are the important things. But we do need an informed electorate out there. It's not going to happen unless people know about these issues, and education is our necessity. Sounds kind of boring, doesn't it? Wouldn't it be nice if we could just jump right into politics? But people won't know what we're talking about unless they understand the issues. We need an educational army out there, ladies and gentlemen. And it's time to enlist. As Patrick Henry would have said it, in fact, as he did say it, our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? The bad news, the really bad news, is that time is running out. We used to talk about these things. I remember not too long ago, I would talk about some of these issues, and people would look at me and say, "You got to be kidding. That could never happen in America." And now, when I talk about these issues, they lean forward and say, "How much time do we have left?" It's visible all around us. The New World Order is descending around us. I mean, they're preparing a world court of justice, a world taxing authority, a world monetary unit, a world army. As we speak, over half of our standing military right now is serving under foreign officers at the UN, and the process is rapidly moving. So, ladies and gentlemen, time is running out. Whatever you plan to do for your country or for your freedom, do it now. But the good news is, the really good news is, that we still can do it. We still have time. We still have freedom. Instead of complaining about how bad things are or how late the hour is, we should rejoice over the fact that we can still meet as we are here tonight. We can still talk openly. We can still advocate such things as the abolition of the Federal Reserve System. We still have elections. We should rejoice on that fact. All we have to do is go out and work like our very lives and our freedom depended upon it. Because they do. And I think a good place to begin is to send Epictetus back to Phrygia and to convert that grand appearance of the fourth kind into a disappearance of the first kind. Thank you very much.
Well, that's the end of this episode and the wrap-up of the New World Order and conspiracy theory of the Federal Reserve, which is the U.S. government banking system. I hope you enjoyed it. Join us next week as we continue to search for the cosmic truth.